What's up, Jane Austen addicts? Welcome to the Jesus Movies podcast, where we search movies for lines, scenes, characters, and themes that trace truth and the gospel. I'm Kevin Carlock. I'm here with my fellow gentleman, Graham Hooten, and our hope is that you'll join us on the great journey of storytelling by asking thoughtful questions about why certain movies and moments resonate or don't resonate, and what that might say about the movie, about you, and perhaps about humanity as a whole. Today, we're talking about Pride and Prejudice, and Graham, my one question for you is Pride a fault or a virtue?
I'm going to have to go fault there, Kev. I know that you love this movie. I am a first-time watcher of Pride and Prejudice, and so we are coming in with very different experiences, which gets me excited to talk with you today about this 2005 Jane Austen film.
Yeah, so I've probably seen it about 15 times. I'm more curious to your thoughts, but I'll lead off by saying I think it's one of the most artful movies that I've ever seen. It's visual and musical and stunning. The directing is masterful from Joe Wright. He and composer Dario Marianelli have a longstanding Hollywood famous professional relationship that we'll dive into more. As you know, I am obsessed with movie music, but Graham, first time viewing, I just have to know, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I need you to brace yourself.
No, don't.
I hated this movie.
Are you kidding me? Titanic and then this? Do you have a heart?
Okay, so here's my thing. It's less a critique against the movie art making itself. I think that it's really well shot. I think the acting is good. I think the cinematography is fantastic. Maybe it's just that I have a tough time latching onto stories about 19th century British women whose entire objective in life is to get married. I don't think I resonated with it particularly that much. That's not to say that it isn't a very well-written book and very well-acted adaptation, but I am glad to be one and done with this one, Kev.
Oh my gosh, a part of me just died inside. did you have a favorite character?
Maybe we'll wait to save that for my Jesus Award. So we're going to get into, okay. Can I start off by saying I do have multiple least favorite characters?
Yeah, fire away.
Okay. Elizabeth's younger sisters are perhaps two of the most annoying movie characters that I have ever encountered. The constant squealing and throwing themselves onto the couch.
Are we talking about Lydia and Kitty?
We're talking about Lydia and Kitty. And then I would say, you know, Mrs. Bennet is a close second behind those two that are tied at the top. A lot of squealing, a lot of eavesdropping.
It was not put in the papers as it should have been.
I will say I really did enjoy seeing Donald Sutherland out there as Mr. Bennet. Reminds me a little bit of his role as President Snow. I don't know. Kev, I mean, help save this for me. Why do you think that Pride and Prejudice hits home so strongly for you?
I mean, it could be that I have a massive crush on Lizzie Bennet. Mm. It could be that I literally am Lizzie Bennet. and maybe this opens an uncomfortable conversation about our recent Hinge experiences,
ooh,
Graham. But I do admire how Lizzie knows what she wants and is sort of fearless and courageous and bold and doesn't settle. Mm. Yeah, maybe I kind of feel like she's an Enneagram 1.
So would you argue that Lizzie knows what she wants or she kind of stumbles upon what she wants? Because the clarity really shifts throughout the film.
I think she knows what she wants, but she has to learn that Darcy is that.
So she's just waiting to find out that Darcy actually is the one that she wants. She doesn't discover that Darcy, I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit confused as to, you know, does Darcy become the one or is he the one that all along has been the one? I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting caught up in semantics here.
Well, I think she is going to say at the end, and we'll talk about this in the awards, but like, I was entirely wrong about him. He's not who I thought he was.
Mm.
Who he actually is the person that she was looking for in the beginning. She just didn't realize it. And neither did he.
Interesting. Yeah. Also got to shout out some of the hairdos going on in this film here. I don't really know what Darcy is rocking there. It's kind of like the mullet with the sideburns. I guess that must have, you know, been pretty popular in Britain back in the days. But some interesting hair work going on. And I'll be honest, for the most part, I don't get a lot from Darcy. I understand that he as a character is meant to be very subtle, that a lot of his emotions are subdued and subverted with the hopes of maintaining this, I don't know, stoic and pristine facade. But I don't know, he doesn't really do it for me. And maybe it's because I'm looking at it from a man's perspective and not a woman's perspective. I don't know. Do you find Mr. Darcy at the end of it all to be a very appealing gentleman that is worthy of having Lizzie's hand in marriage?
I do. I think I'm asking myself how I can be more like Darcy.
Oh, okay. Talk me through it. What do you feel like are some of his most appealing attributes?
I think he's humble. I think he is quick to listen and slow to speak. I think that he does his good deeds for the sake of doing the good deed and not to be recognized for it. But I'm going to segue that into a question for you, Graham. Kev's conspiracy theory corner.
Oh.
Do you think Darcy could have floated the Darcy Elizabeth romance rumor to Lady Catherine via Collins or Georgiana or Fitzwilliam to see if there was any hope left? Because there is kind of this question for me, at least based on the movie, of like, how does Lady Catherine de Bourgh find out that there's a rumor that Lizzie Bennet might have captured the heart of Mr. Darcy?
That doesn't really feel like one of his moves, right? I mean, I think one of the characteristics we've seen building about him is that he works behind the scenes. He's like a, like Lil Wayne says, real G's move in silence like lasagna. I feel like that's kind of his MO. He's helping out with, you know, the sister's marriage, and he's trying to throw Mr. Bingley a bone and trying to help him get what he wants and what he thinks Jane actually wants. So it doesn't seem like his MO to float out some sort of conspiracy theory. I don't know. Do you buy into that?
No, not at all. Okay. I do kind of wonder. I think it had to be Georgiana maybe, but on accident. Also doing a little bit of internet research on the music of this. Composed, like I said, Dario Marianelli, Jean-Vez Thibaudet, a piano, one of the best pianists in the world. According to Marianelli, he loved working with him in the English Chamber Orchestra. Academy Award nominated, but not victorious, although this partnership would go on to be victorious with Atonement in that score. And they would go on to work on The Soloist and Anna Karenina, another novel adaptation, Darkest Hour. I actually ended up reading this really fascinating Tumblr post, Graham, about how the music in Pride and Prejudice is debated, whether it's drawn from Mozart or Beethoven. Mm. So pretty much everyone agrees that Austen's 1813 novel is situated about 15 years ago, like 1796 to 97, which would put it like firmly in the middle of the classical musical period. But then even though in some early interviews, Marianelli like cites Beethoven's sonatas as the earliest inspiration and sort of guiding true north compass for what the music of this movie would be like. And maybe this seems in the weeds to you, but I ended up reading this like girl, Mariah Gillespie's 2011 University of Michigan thesis on whether it was basically Mozart or Beethoven. She cites this guy, Robert K. Wallace, who wrote an entire book comparing Jane Austen's work to Mozart's, with a lengthy chapter on Pride and Prejudice in which the three movements of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 9, K271, correlate to the three volumes of Pride and Prejudice in their falling in and out of love with their respective romantic and musical protagonists and conflicts. And then there's like special emphasis that's given to the thirds and broken thirds in the base of the living sculptures of Pemberley, when like Lizzie is like walking through Darcy's house and like admiring all the statues. You remember that scene?
Yeah, sure.
Kind of argue that that's like the turning point for her feelings about Darcy based on the music. It's kind of what this girl's thesis was arguing. Anyway, massive internet rabbit hole for me. Spent like more than a couple hours.
Leave it to you to go on the deep internet deep dive comparing Mozart to Jane Austen. Wow.
Was this movie what you thought it would be?
I honestly didn't have strong expectations. I will tell you, the entirety of my exposure to Pride and Prejudice comes from a YouTube video that you made a number of years ago titled, What If Pride and Prejudice Was Avengers Endgame? I would definitely recommend that our listeners check that out.
Yeah, that was when the trailer for Endgame came out and like everyone was doing like spoofs on it. And I was like, I'll join the party. I'll make one for Pride and Prejudice. Do you have any story questions? I know it's your first time. It's a lot to take in. Is there anything that didn't make sense or things you wanted to see more of or less of?
I was a little bit confused with Lydia, why it went from, oh, no, 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 to yes, yes, yes. Like why the parents were way out, I guess, when she eloped, and then I guess way in when Wickham shows back up. I guess they're scared about their daughter running away.
My impression was that the other girls would not be able to marry.
Yeah, especially in this world where it feels like reputation and status means everything.
Right.
The unsanctioned marriage can have a drastic social effect on the family.
Mr. Wickham.
Mr. Wickham.
We've got a lot to get through, Graham. Should we get to the awards?
Yeah, let's do it, baby.
Give me your Lazarus Award for the high-key gospel moment of the movie that you did not like.
My Lazarus Award goes to the scene where Darcy walks to meet Elizabeth in the field.
Jane also, it is I who should be making amends.
And this is also my pulpit pick. Like I said, I don't particularly like this film, but this is by far my favorite scene in Pride and Prejudice. We've got the high-minded, prideful British elite who makes his way to the common woman via foot. Throughout most of the film, we see Darcy showing up on carriage or he's on horseback.
Tell me, do you and your sisters very often walk to Meryton?
He, after all, is a prideful British gentleman that will not be subjected to walking from destination to destination, unlike the very instance where Elizabeth walks all the way to meet Mr. Darcy through the fields.
Good Lord, Miss Elizabeth, did you walk here?
I did.
And we see Darcy in this moment humble himself and choose Lizzie's medium of traveling to go and encounter her to express his love.
I'm very fond of walking.
Yes.
And this reminds me of this song that is done by Mercy Worship, which is actually the church I attend here in Charlotte. It's called When the King Left His Throne. And it's an original song. It came out a couple of years ago. I won't read you all the lyrics, but the general sentiment is that Jesus is the Son of God, seated at the right hand of God in heaven. And when the king left his throne is when Jesus, the Word, became incarnate and dwelt among us. This is referencing John 1:14. The ESV says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Rick Palmer is a guy I really look up to. He works for Young Life, which is the same organization that I work for, and he's based out of Columbia, and he has this phrase when he talks about the incarnate Jesus. He says, Jesus is God on his knees, and uses this example of when he talks to his son and tries to get on his level and empathize with him, Rick will go on his knees and look his son directly in his eyes. And it's a way of humanizing himself and demonstrating vulnerability and hopes to convey a compassionate message. And God the Father, obviously, is seated in heaven, but Jesus is God on earth. He is God with skin on, and Jesus is the Word made flesh, meaning that is God in his most vulnerable form, and actually in the form of the humans that he created. And so this further emphasized in Philippians 2:8, which says, in being found in human form, he, this is talking about Jesus, humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And so what I really love about incarnation and this idea of Jesus becoming the Word made flesh is that he is demonstrating vulnerability by encountering us in the very form in which we exist. He is not calling us to become greater. He is not saying that we must become more like him in greatness and in power in order that we might become equals. He actually stoops down and meets us right where we are. Again, God on his knees is Jesus looking right across from us, inviting us into one-on-one relationship that is not just vertical, but horizontal as well, which is something that you talk about a lot. There's this line that Darcy has. He says, I have struggled in vain and I cannot bear it no longer. I came with the single object of seeing you. I have fought against my better judgment, my family's expectations, the inferiority of your birth by rank and circumstance. All these things I am willing to go aside, willing to put aside, and ask you to end my agony.
Miss Elizabeth, I have struggled in vain and I can bear it no longer. These past months have been a torment. I came to Rosings with the single object of seeing you. I had to see you. I have fought against my better judgment, my family's expectation, the inferiority of your birth, my rank and circumstance, all these things, and I'm willing to put them aside and ask you to end my agony.
I don't understand.
I love you. Most ardently.
And that doesn't come from that scene. It comes from the scene where the rain is pouring down and he's expressing his true love to Lizzie. But I think this is the kind of crazy love that Jesus demonstrates, which is a willingness to abandon the highest position of paradise in order to be with us. He came that we too may one day be able to enter into that world with him. And so for me, that's why this wins my Lazarus Award.
Yeah, I totally agree. So my question is, was it enjoyable to watch?
It was enjoyable to watch, certainly. I do feel like this movie plays very strongly with like this tension of like, will they kiss or won't they kiss? This is not a very physically affectionate film, especially contrasted to a lot of modern romantic movies. And obviously it's set in a specific time period that's not going to enable that in the same way. And so I feel like I could have gone for maybe a little bit more expressive. But yeah, I would say this was the most enjoyable scene of the film for me.
Number one. Okay, wow. Yeah, as far as the kiss goes, I think the true Jane Austen fans would be livid with the ending in which the way too beautiful Keira Knightley kisses Matthew McFadden. Like, that's, I want to say that's not in the book. And definitely they toy with it in that rain first proposal scene in a way that feels very movie worldy.
Yeah. Kev, you want to take me to your Lazarus Award?
I have picked the same Lazarus Award, and it is also my pulpit pick. Buckle up.
Okay.
It's a two-parter. I'm going to accelerate the first part because it's Elizabeth and Darcy getting together. The second part is Elizabeth and Mr. Bennet kind of debriefing in the study.
Okay.
So each part's going to have an A, B, and C. I'm limiting myself to three nuggets from each. But the reason I'm doing a two-parter is because I think it's ultimately the same idea, which is Elizabeth Darcy finally get together.
After what you have done for Lydia, and I suspect for Jane also, it is I who should be making amends.
You must know. Surely you must know. It was all for you. You are too generous to travel with me. I believe you spoke with my aunt last night, and it has taught me to hope, as I had scarcely allowed myself before. If your feelings are still what they were last April, tell me so at once. My affections and wishes have not changed. But one word from you will silence me forever. If, however, your feelings have changed, I would have to tell you. You have bewitched me, body and soul, and I love, and love, and love you. And never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
So the first is, surely you must know, it was all for you.
You must know. Surely you must know, it was all for you.
I think that parallels how God works everything to draw his people to him. He does it all for us, from that weird youth pastor's joke that you oddly still remember, to the late night hug from that friend who said all the wrong things, to sending his son on the cross. It was all for you. Surely you must know, you must know. All the thoughts and the feelings and the people and the events of your life have been divinely orchestrated, meticulously planned one by one by one to bring you to God. You must know, surely you must know, it's all for you. Don't believe me? Let's take a look with some scripture. Ephesians 1:11. In him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Job 42:2. My boy Graham's been in Job lately. How's this for some resolution? I know that you can do all things, says Job, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Isaiah 46:9-11. For I am God and there is no other. I am God and there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my counsel from a far country, I have spoken and I will bring it to pass. I have purposed and I will do it. Part two, my affections and wishes have not changed.
My affections and wishes have not changed.
Darcy's love is a smaller version of God's love in that it has not, does not change. God's hand is outstretched to the unsaved and the saved alike, never letting a single sheep escape. Lots of scripture here because this is an important one. And we're talking about Calvinism, tulip, P, perseverance of the saints for believers, but we're also talking about conversion for non-believers. So Malachi 3:6, For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. Numbers 23:19. God is not a man that he should lie, or a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it? Hebrews 13:8. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. And then this is a great one, Philippians 1:6. And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. And part three, I love you. I never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
You have bewitched me, body and soul, and I love you. I never wish to be parted from you from this day on.
God prepares a place, a Pemberley estate, for us. John 14:1-3. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If were not so, would I not have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. Revelation 21:3. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. So any questions? I'm going to pause there. Those are the three lines I picked out from that exchange.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the great things about Darcy, if I do allow myself to admit it, is his persistence. Like, once he determines what he wants, he is willing to go all out about it. And I think another scene that really stuck with me, or maybe it was a line specifically, when he's like, if you say no, like, I will pursue this no further, and I will leave you alone.
But one word from you will silence me forever.
A just God allows for us to choose, or at least have some sort of agency in allowing ourselves to accept the gift. The gift isn't forced upon us. Does that make sense? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't know enough to really be able to handle this conversation with, like, excellent word distinction. I think the idea is more so that, like, the Holy Spirit bats 1,000. God's salvation is effectual. It always works. And, like, for those whom he has called to salvation, he is going to divinely orchestrate the events of their life to where choosing Jesus will always be appealing, always be attractive, that they will choose Jesus 100 times out of 100. Mm-hmm. Can a leopard change its spots? Do choices constrain nature, or do nature constrain choices? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the thought. All right, so now the following scene, Elizabeth and her father in the house.
They say, are you out of your senses? I thought you hated the man.
No, Papa.
He's rich, to be sure. He would have more fine carriages than Jane. But would that make you happy?
Have you no other objection than your belief in my indifference?
None at all. We all know him to be a proud, unpleasant sort of fellow. But this would be nothing if you really liked him.
I do like him.
Yeah.
I love him. He's not proud. I was wrong. I was entirely wrong about him. You don't know him, Papa, if I told you what he was really like, what he's done.
What has he done? Good Lord. I must pay him back.
No. You mustn't tell anyone. He wouldn't want it. We misjudged him, Papa, me more than anyone, in every way, not just in this matter. I've been nonsensical. He's been a fool about Jane, about so many other things, but then so have I. You see, he and I are so similar. We're both so stubborn. Papa, I...
You really do love him, don't you? Anyone can deserve you. But it seems I am overruled. So, I heartily give my consent. I could not have parted with you, my Lizzie, to anyone less worthy.
So that might be the most emotional scene in the entire movie for me. My first pick is, he's not proud. I was wrong. I was entirely wrong about him. You don't know him, Papa. I told you what he was like, what he's done.
He's not proud. I was wrong. I was entirely wrong about him. You don't know him, Papa. If I told you what he was really like, what he's done.
And so at the core of becoming a Christian and growing in our relationship with Jesus is an evolving understanding of who God is, what he's really like, what he's done. It's shedding our former, smaller, falser understanding of who God is and falling in love with the bigger and bigger, more and more truthful, daily more and more beautiful knowledge of his being. And that can mean admitting that we were wrong and praying to better behold his beauty, as Shylin says. And so Ephesians 1:18, having the eyes of your hearts enlightened, that you may know what is the hope to which he has called you, what are the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints. Having the eyes of your hearts enlightened, Graham, God is going to supernaturally reveal who he is to you over time and in his way. 2 Corinthians 4:6, talking more sanctification. For God, who said, let light shine out of the darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. He has shined the light into our hearts. John 17:17, sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. Kind of a simpler version of saying the same thing. And so for the unbeliever, this might look like Belle's revelation in Beauty and the Beast. Bittersweet and strange, finding you can change, learning you were wrong.
Tale as old as time, tune as old as song, bittersweet and strange, finding you can change, learning you were wrong.
Well, what a beautiful thing to be able to be shown that you were wrong, right? When that wrong thing is right and better and more beautiful and more truthful. This is one I think of more so for believers. Shylin's song, With All My Mind.
And forever we will cling to the crucified and risen king who fulfilled the plan you devised. Theology helps to separate truth from lies, but you are not an object to be scrutinized. You're not a philosophy, you are not a theory. You're not an apologetic debate topic merely. You're a person who deserves to be adored. Our goal in life should simply be to see you more, to have our soul satisfied and be so amazed, to stand in awe when you teach us to know your ways, to bring glory to your holy name forevermore. We were made for so much more than what we settle for. We're too easily satisfied with lesser things. They're distractions that keep us from our blessed King. Theology is not a goal, but its major purpose is to think about you rightly when we praise and worship.
He's not proud. I was wrong. I was entirely wrong about him. Bittersweet and strange, finding you can change, learning you were wrong, Graham. Point two, good Lord, I must pay him back.
Good Lord, I must pay him back.
No.
Maybe you remember when Mr. Bennett sort of sinks into his chair with sort of that overwhelming burden of, oh my gosh, Darcy has done everything for me and my family, and I had no idea. And I think this drew a parallel for me of like, this really is our instinct when we take Jesus' atonement seriously. Like, so much so that we often stray from what the Christian life really is. Like, we can actually lean into this kind of feeling too much. And so this is why Jesus says in John 6, when the disciples say to him, what must we do to be doing the works of God? Verse 29, Jesus answered them, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. Mr. Bennett's job here is to be thankful for what Darcy's done for him. And then part three, I cannot believe that anyone can deserve you. I could not have parted with you, my Lizzie, to anyone less worthy.
I cannot believe that anyone can deserve you. I could not have parted with you, my Lizzie, to anyone less worthy.
And I think God has this similarly high view for us. And it's not that he's giving us away. It's kind of the opposite. But that he's jealous for our time and our energy and our affections with choosing a spouse, choosing friends, choosing a city, choosing a job, and maybe above all, choosing a church. His laws are in place because he's all too keenly aware of how these decisions affect our hearts. And that's why in the Old Testament, right, God is so jealous for his people and is so intense about keeping false religions around them at bay, Judges 2, 1 through 2. Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. What is this that you have done? Can you hear God's deep disappointment with the Israelites there? And then this is kind of the more famous passage here, Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them and show them no mercy. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their Asherim poles and burn their carved images with fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Intensity, Graham. He's jealous of us. I could not have parted with you, my Lizzie, to anyone less worthy. That's the sentiment that God feels towards us. So there you have it. Part one, part two. Three nuggets from each.
Wow. What a behemoth of a Lazarus Award.
I promise the next three awards will be very short.
A lot of content there. The one that sticks with me the most is the attitude of Mr. Bennett. Is the immediate reaction, like, how do I pay him back? And I love what you said. Like, the way we pay God back is that we can't. We respond in thankfulness and gratitude, and out of gratitude come these works of faith, of living the life that God has invited us into. So I think that's a really beautiful picture about just the extravagance of God's love and how it's almost embarrassing. It's undressing, and there's no way to respond but worshiping him and living the life that he has allowed us to live.
Right. And I think sometimes that sentiment is sort of distorted when it's like, God has done this amazing thing for you, therefore you should go obey, and like, that's your way to kind of do your part, you know, like, he died for you, now you go live a life that's pleasing to him. And I don't think that's exactly what I think. The idea of justification by grace, sanctification by grace, is that God has supernaturally changed your heart. He's replaced your heart of stone with a heart of flesh, to quote Ezekiel 36. If you really do believe the gospel, the good news, and the Holy Spirit has entered your heart, he's going to change you, and your life will start to look differently. It's not that we're, you know, doing our part. There's no part of the bargain here. He's done everything.
Yeah.
But don't you feel like sometimes that gets twisted in Christian circles a little bit? It's sort of like, you've been saved by grace, therefore, like, it's your responsibility to obey the law, and that's your motive for doing it.
Yeah, we don't actually have to do anything.
Totally.
One time it was phrased to me by some people who led me in college and mentored me, is that ministry is not our gift to God. It is God's gift to us, meaning that we have in no way the ability to repay the debt for what he's done for us. Everything we do is purely reactionary to the grace and mercy that he has demonstrated towards us.
Lizzie, are you out of your senses? I thought you hated the man. No, Papa. On that note, your Mary Magdalene Award for a low-key gospel moment in the movie that you did not like.
Just going back to the bottle on that one.
I can't believe it.
My Mary Magdalene Award goes to this very short exchange between Darcy and Elizabeth. So, what do you recommend to encourage affection? Dancing, even if one's partner is barely tolerable.
I wonder who first discovered the power of poetry in driving away love.
I thought the poetry was the food of love.
Of a fine, stout love, it may. But if it is only a vague inclination, I'm convinced one poor sonnet will kill it stone dead.
So, what do you recommend to encourage affection?
Dancing, even if one's partner is barely tolerable.
So I'd like to pull a passage from this Bible study that I found. It's called Music of the Gospel, and it's written for CRU, which is a college campus ministry by this guy named Dr. Keith Johnson, who's a PhD. I'm going to read a couple paragraphs of it just to set the stage for what I'm going to talk about. Imagine yourself in a large house in which those who are deaf and those who can hear are living together. In one of the rooms, you see a guy sitting in a chair and listening to music on his iPod. Rhythmically, he's tapping his foot, drumming his thighs, jutting his chin out, swaying to the beat, and pursing his lips like Mick Jagger or someone. His entire body moves in response to what his ears are hearing. It's obvious that he's enjoying himself and listening to a pretty good song. A few minutes later, one of the deaf persons enters the room. Seeing the guy listening to the music and impersonating Mick Jagger, he thinks, "That looks like fun. I think I'll try that." So he sits down next to him and begins to imitate him. Awkwardly at first, he tries drumming his thighs, jutting his chin out, and swaying to the music just like the guy with the iPod. With a little practice, he begins to catch on to it. By watching and trying, he begins to mirror the other guy's actions pretty closely. But although he eventually gets better at keeping time, he concludes that it's not as much fun or as easy as it initially seemed, especially the chin jut, just very difficult to do when you're not actually hearing the music. There's an important spiritual parallel here. The dance, outward actions, represents the Christian life, while the music represents the grace of the gospel. Though we have come to know Christ through grace, we are often like the deaf man in the story who tries to perform the dance without hearing the music. Our spiritual life is reduced to a series of dance steps, external behaviors and activities, devoid of God's animating and transforming power. God's desire is not for us to get us to do the dance, but to get us to hear the music of the gospel, with the dance, godly actions, character, and activities flowing naturally from it. I don't know if you've gotten the chance to do a silent disco. I've never done one, but I've seen many videos, and it's kind of hilarious because you see all these people dancing around with these headphones on their head, and clearly it looks like they're having a great time, but as an outward spectator, you have no idea what's going on in those headphones. But I think maybe this is a good picture of what it looks like to look in on somebody who's living a life actively following Jesus without understanding the truth and hope of the gospel. It looks like somebody dancing without the music. And so I want to reiterate that our responsibility as believers is not to dance more or dance harder or dance better. It's simply to pull up a chair and listen and strap on those headphones and live a life that is centered on prayer and solitude, that has time spent saturated in the word, community, fellowship with believers, because it is through hearing the gospel and allowing it to wash over us in these different realms that we get inspired to go and dance. You can't help but dance when music is playing. And I know that with wedding season coming up this spring, we're going to be out on the dance floor again. But a dance floor without music is really, it's a sad dance floor. And so I wanted to pull this verse, which maybe feels a little bit out of context, which is James chapter 2, verses 14 through 17, which is a classic faith versus works. It says, "What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to him, 'Go in peace, be warmed and filled,' without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead." So the works in this instance spurs on greater affection, while the affection spurs on greater works. This is the tandem rhythm of the Christian life here. One does not exist without the other. This vast kind of spiritual metaphor is kind of stuck with me, and so that's why I chose that line for my Mary Magdalene Award.
Interesting. Okay. I'm pretty confused. I feel like I heard a lot of Christianese, and I'm like, what is the actual parallel? What are you talking about? How do you tie it to Darcy and Lizzie dancing, even if one's partner is barely tolerable?
I think that Darcy, as we later find out, is a solid character, right? Like, he's an honest man. He is a gentleman. He demonstrates righteous anger towards Wickham for what he's done wrong to his father and his father's estate. He has the internal, I guess, fortitude of somebody who's worth marrying Lizzie, but his outward actions don't express that. Whereas I feel like Lizzie is all maybe outward expressions, but doesn't understand the internal reality of who Darcy himself is. So maybe there's like a little bit of a disconnect on that front.
Okay. That helped. Thanks.
All right, Kev, take me to your Mary Magdalene Award.
I have to confess, when you unveiled your Mary Magdalene Award, there was a pit in my stomach because I picked the exact same one.
Really?
This is what happens, guys. When Graham and I don't share notes, we just pick all the same awards.
Okay.
So we used to share our notes a little bit so that we wouldn't do the same things, but we'd try to keep authentic reactions by not telling each other if we liked or not liked the movie.
Yeah.
But now we've just gone straight rogue where it's like, only surprises. Don't even look at me until we record.
Mm.
And this is kind of the downside of that, but maybe it's the upside because we took very different directions of it. So we're actually going to get to do what I like most about this podcast, which is hopefully going narrow and deep. Now we're just really hammering this one moment because I went in a different direction. So for me, this was a Mary Magdalene moment because it's the first time that Darcy takes Lizzie seriously. Perhaps the story's inciting incident. It's a little bit dependent on how you define that story beat. But God's pointed omniscience can be the inciting incident of saving faith in the same way. Like this could be you thinking that God doesn't care about social justice only to read a passage later that day within sufficient context that commands elected leaders to provide for the poor. Or this could be you thinking Christianity is something that you do in your own way on your own time, only to read a passage later that commands believers to regularly gather in song and word and sacraments. Or in my case, this could be like a pastor who recalls tiny, tiny details from a conversation 2 years ago, which shocks you into thinking, wow, maybe he really does care about me. Wow, maybe I'm missing something here. Whatever it is, God's ability to use his word and people and the events of our lives to hit us where it hurts the most can be the much needed spark, just like it was for Darcy.
I've never seen so many pretty girls in my life.
You are dancing with the only handsome girl in the room.
She is the most beautiful creature I have ever beheld. But her sister Elizabeth is very agreeable.
Perfectly tolerable, I dare say. Not handsome enough to tempt me.
The way that she is able to overhear him, and then she throws it kind of back in her face in sort of a coy, witty way, is like really grabs his attention. Like there's a competence displayed there, also a little bit of a bitterness maybe, but you know, it's captivating. Like she's basically saying like, I know that you've written me off and I'm still here.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of the inciting incident of their romance. And you might not think that Jesus is like that. Like that seems a little bit Machiavellian for Jesus to like, maybe he's not that way. And so like, I'm going to kind of show you maybe that he kind of can be. And this is Luke 18 verses 18 to 22. The rich young ruler, although in scripture he's actually never called the rich young ruler. That's just like what we, when we amalgamate all the traits from him from the different gospel accounts. But anyways, verse 18, and a ruler asked Jesus, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus said to him, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother. And the ruler said, all these I've kept from my youth. When Jesus heard this, he said to the ruler, one thing you still lack, sell all that you have and distribute to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. But when he heard these things, he became very sad, for he was extremely rich. And we've talked about this moment in Jesus' ministry on this podcast before, but one thing that I recently learned through my church is that there's two tablets of the Ten Commandments. And if you look at it, Jesus rattles off adultery, murder, stealing, lying, and then honoring your father and mother here. The only one that he leaves off of the second tablet is do not covet. And so there's sort of this like odd omission of do not covet from the ones that Jesus has listed here. And so Jesus is kind of like setting him up to say, hey, maybe you actually aren't keeping this one. And scholars have kind of linked do not covet to the first commandment, like you shall have no other gods before me. That money is ultimately what he's coveting in the God that's before him. In a weird way, like what Jesus is not saying here is doing the pointed thing that Elizabeth is doing to Darcy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I will say that this is one of the more endearing Lizzie scenes that I get in this film, is like a woman who is 100% confident in who she is and is willing to call out his character and hold him to a higher standard that he's clearly not living at. Like, I think that's a really admirable quality in an individual.
Yeah, totally. I think my favorite scenes in the movie might be the ones where Lizzie is kind of sparring, the most of which I actually had a kind of a late night text convo with a friend who also loves this movie. And we were talking about how we both love when Lizzie is at Lady Catherine de Bourgh's kind of dinner table. And Lady Catherine's just sort of trying to roast her with all these big questions. Do you draw? Oh, that's very odd indeed. And Lizzie's just kind of like, you know, I hardly think that that would encourage sisterly affection. Like, she's just going toe-to-toe, like, I'm not scared of your prominence or your age or your wealth. Like, this is what I believe. And I'm not saying Jesus would be quite that dismissive or maybe even disrespectful to someone that's older than her like that. Like, I don't know that that's the most Christ-like, but I think the fearlessness and the bravery and the courage and the boldness is something that is Christ-like, something that I admire, and something that I'm looking to marry.
Upon my word, you give your opinion very decidedly for so young a person. Pray, what is your age?
With three younger sisters grown up, your ladyship can hardly expect me to own to it.
Give me the False Prophet Award for a non-biblical argument that this great movie that you don't like makes.
My False Prophet Award goes to The Idolatry of Marriage. Which I guess we're gonna find out if you chose this one too. We're two for two on the front end here.
Oh boy.
Full confession, I find Mrs. Bennett incredibly annoying, and I get part of it is her circumstance being a mother of five daughters whose primary job within that cultural context is to get her daughters married. But it seems like all she worries about is marriage, and the greatest end to their lives, the lives of her daughters, is finding a suitable spouse that's gonna take care of them so that they can have children of their own, and that this cycle can continue over and over again. And so even if Elizabeth seems to rebel against this, I still think Pride and Prejudice is a happy film because it ends in marriage. It is a film that celebrates the sanctity of marriage, which is a good thing, but in some ways, in this cultural context, is viewed as being the end-all be-all. And Kev, you and I both know that being single can be hard in the church. And even we're relatively on the younger end of a lot of single Christians, and maybe I'd, you know, if I'm being honest, I'd rather be in the single male's position than a single female's position.
No, Graham, yeah. We're being disobedient. We're in the lobby of life. That the better version of us would be married.
We're living in JV Christianity. And
we're JV.
I'm going to shout out Paul here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 8 through 9, giving a little spice on marriage. Now, to the unmarried and the widows, I say it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Other translations say lust. Obviously, we know that Jesus was single, Paul was single, a lot of great church leaders over the course of history have been single, and this idolatry of marriage just seems to be taking the place of God, and he is what ultimately completes us. It is not another individual that completes us. That's why this 100% wins my False Prophet Award.
Does the movie really argue that marriage is ultimate?
I would say it definitely leans on that end. And that's why I tried to throw in that caveat that Elizabeth seems to fight a little bit against this notion, but it has a happy ending because Elizabeth gets married. Like,
but what's the difference between an idol and something that you're trying to be wise about? Something that represents so much of what will affect your choices and circumstances?
Sure. I think it's just the unhealthy obsession that we see from Mrs. Bennett. It's the constant eavesdropping, the constant waiting for the letters, the constant trying to make one move to set some other daughter up. Like, it's this chess game of thing, something that must be achieved in order to, like, set up a family's greater success. And again, I'm not a woman. I didn't live in 19th century England. I don't know fully what that cultural context is like. But
no, thanks for clearing that up. I mean, look, when you have five daughters, Graham, tell me what else will occupy your thoughts, and then perhaps you'll understand.
Exactly. Do not have five. My thoughts are often occupied by things other than getting my five daughters married.
Daughter, marry, is that really all you think about? When you have five daughters, Lizzie, tell me what else will occupy your thoughts, and then perhaps you will understand.
I just think it's a little bit of the, I just need to stand by the door and eavesdrop on every conversation, because this is going to be like the ultimate.
Maybe the 21st century America version is like the job a little bit, like,
right.
It's the definer of status and the identity clinger, and like the way that we carve an image of ourselves and how we see ourselves and how we expect others to see ourselves and how we try to achieve meaning and purpose. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. And I am not at all saying that I am above that. I think that's the last thing I want to claim.
Well, that was what I was hearing you say, so I'm glad you backed that off.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to keep the convo going because I've got the same False Prophet Award, but I did subtly roast you here on accident because I wrote, marriage is ultimate is so obvious, so let's get more specific. Marriage is built on the foundation of common traits and values, which is close, but I'd like to go a little bit further and add common destination. Because Lizzie, you know, she says, he and I are so alike, Papa. That's great. I want to marry someone that's alike me, but it's not... Mm-hmm. Everything, right? Like, how about he and I want to be the same kind of person or want to end up in the same place? Tim Keller has this quote in The Meaning of Marriage where he says, within this Christian vision of marriage, here's what it means to fall in love. It's to look at another person and get a glimpse of what God is creating and to say, I see who God is making you and it excites me. I want to be a part of it. I want to partner with you and God in the journey you're taking to his throne. And when we get there, I'll look at your magnificence and say, I always knew you could be like this. I got glimpses of it on earth, but now look at you. And sort of partnering in the sanctification and being kind of in the front seat for it. And Graham, maybe that's a question for me and for you in our singleness is like, how much do we account for that sanctification when deciding who to marry? versus how much do we sort of try to marry someone who's farther along or more mature in their faith? Does that make sense?
I mean, I think it's going to be different for different people, right? I think the Detroit Pistons are better off drafting Nikola Jokic, where the, you know, Cleveland Cavaliers could really settle with Evan Mobley at center. Like, I do think that it's different for different individuals, and there's not necessarily a universal metric. Maybe some, like, underlying shared values. Obviously, a mutual pursuit of Christ.
I think it's hilarious that we can't even have a conversation without it just going to, like, sports and draft picks. And, like, it just shows our yeah, desire 100%. To be with women who will level us out a little bit. Also, I didn't give you my verse. 2 Corinthians 3:18. And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. In case you hadn't had enough sanctification by grace verses on this podcast, here's yet another one. Guys, you can't do this. The Spirit is going to do it. And what a treat to get to watch him do it to the person that you marry. So that's the thing that I would add to Lizzie and Darcy. But man, I think this movie really hits the nail on the head. There's so much to be affirmed here. I know Graham, you might not like it, but I think if we were to try to sort of like rank on a scale 1 to 10 of like biblical values, I feel like this one is higher, because even if you want to go after Mrs. Bennet, like, she's clearly not held up as the noble, right? It's like Jane and Lizzie that are to be admired, and Darcy, not the Wickhams, not the Mr. Collins at your service. My, what excellent boiled potatoes. Saw a great meme on that where, like, it was photoshopped a potato on Lizzie's head and in Mr. Collins' face over the thing, and it was called, like, Pride and Potatoes, and the subtitle was, like, my, what excellent boiled potatoes. Anyways.
What Reddit threads are you on?
Give me your Jesus Award for the most Christ-like character in a movie that is so beautiful and amazing and full of truth that you did not like.
I'm going with Mr. Darcy for my Jesus Award.
Oh my gosh, we literally went did we go four for four. 4 for 4 on the same awards.
We're a mess. We're never doing this again.
This is the first time that's ever happened, right?
I guess so. Unbelievable.
I'm kind of pissed because I feel like this is like an episode that I care a lot about and it's ruining it. And I feel like you're secretly happy because you're like, ha ha ha, let's sabotage a movie that's not that great.
So Mr. Darcy, his Christ-like characteristics, he pursues Elizabeth. He sacrifices his high status to come to her lower social level. Again, hearkening back to both Kevin and I, our Lazarus Awards, he walks to meet Elizabeth in the middle of the field. He works behind the scenes to support Elizabeth's sister's marriage.
Miss Bennet.
Mr. Bentley.
I was going.
Carries a righteous anger towards Wickham, which is maybe something we don't touch on a little bit too much, is that I think a righteous anger is a healthy and good thing. Obviously, we talk about
Mr. Wickham,
just flipping tables. We talk about Jesus flipping tables in the temple. Righteous anger is good, and it is justified.
Mr. Wickham.
What excuse can you give you? Your behavior towards him.
You take an eager interest in that gentleman's
concerns.
He told
me of his misfortunes.
Oh, yes, his misfortunes have been very great indeed.
And he demonstrates his happiness by being willing to give up everything to be with Elizabeth. He has this line, "You have bewitched me, body and soul," which I just through watching this movie, I was like, that's where Taylor Swift gets that line in "Kick of My Heart." You know, the song off of Reputation, "Body."
Oh,
and
yeah,
soul.
No, it's one of the most famous lines for sure. I tried to buy some Pride and Prejudice merchandise a couple years ago, and like the only thing I could find was like t-shirts and sweatshirts that said, "You have bewitched me, body and soul, and I love you." And I was like, I can't do it. Sorry. Sorry.
Yeah. Like it's inspiring people, including Taylor Swift and Kevin Carlock. And
dark.
The verse I pulled is 1 John 4, verses 9 through 10. "This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he first loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins." And hearkening back to a little bit more Reformed theology, it is Darcy who initiates this romance. He is the one who loved Lizzie first. He initiates the affections, and he waits around for her to respond earnestly. Similarly, God is the one who initiates his affections, one in the fact that he created us good and in his image, see Genesis 1:27-28, but also that he came in the person of Jesus and pursued humanity first before humanity was willing to pursue God. He is the initiator, he is the author and perfecter of our faith, and he is the one who handles the business, only waiting for us to show up and respond to this proposal of love that he offers, that we might live eternally with him now and forevermore. So that's why Mr. Darcy wins my Jesus Award.
I like it. Who would be your silver medalist?
Lizzie would be my silver medalist. Third place bronze goes to Mr. Bennett, I would say.
Really? Over Jane?
Over Jane, yep.
What do you like about Mr. Bennett?
I like that he is supportive of Lizzie, that while the mother is very pushy about marriage and seems to be so thrown emotionally by every small decision that Lizzie or Jane or any of the daughters makes, the dad seems to be very firm and steady and not swayed by circumstances, but earnestly wanting what's best for his daughters. And especially in that scene that you referenced later, when Lizzie is trying to convince her father to give approval to marry Mr. Darcy, he seems to be genuinely wanting what's best for her. Again, saying like nobody else would be suitable for you, you know?
Love that fatherly defensiveness. Hope to have it someday.
When we have achieved full sanctification by becoming fathers.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Kev. 4 for 4. Just take me to Mr. Darcy. We're already there.
Yeah. I've got honest, sincere, trustworthy, loyal, generous. Certainly generous. But quick to listen, slow to speak, I already talked about. But above all, good deeds in secret. Humility. I think that's what's so compelling and what I'm trying to mimic about Darcy a little bit. And we see it in 2 points I want to talk about. Number one, he doesn't tell Lizzie about Mr. Wickham's crimes during his first proposal. Although you have to wonder if it's just a plot device, because in what world do you not bring up your rationale when you're proposing to the love of your life and that's the thing that's keeping her? You know what I mean? Like, it just seems, this is a little bit of my beef with romance stories sometimes, is that I think in my ideal storytelling world, character conflicts and are really all conflicts are built on like fundamental disagreements. Like in Keira Knightley, let's stick with that. Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, like Will Turner has to choose between Elizabeth and his father. He cannot have both. The Flying Dutchman must have a captain. And a lot of times romance stories are built on misunderstandings. And I think this is kind of one of those stories where it does rely on a lot of misunderstanding because ultimately they are very similar. It doesn't really bother me that much, but it feels like a little bit of a plot hole when Darcy doesn't bring it up. But anyways, his slowness to throw Wickham under the bus, I think, is actually a really biblical and rare trait that I would like to have. You know what I mean? I mean, when was the last time you did something like that, Graham? When someone wronged you and like you had the opportunity to say nothing about it and it cost you to not say anything about it? And
yeah, that never happens.
I mean, that's tough,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's what Darcy models. And sure. He does it at the end, right? No, this is the more obvious one, not telling the Bennets about rescuing Lydia.
Lucky he did come back, or I would have had to ask Mr. Darcy, but I don't really like
Mr. Darcy. Oh, I forgot. But I shouldn't have said a word. Mr. Darcy was at your wedding.
He was the one that discovered us. He paid for the wedding, Wickham's commission, everything. But don't tell anyone, he told me not to tell.
And then redeeming the Bingley-Jane relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I've got Matthew 6, 1 through 4, which would be a little more on the nose. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who's in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing, so that your giving may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. That's a high bar. And then one chapter earlier, Matthew 5, 14 through 16, I think this levels out the spectrum a little bit because I think we can actually take a little too much of that Kool-Aid. So listen to this. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who's in heaven. Graham, is Jesus contradicting himself? Are we supposed to hide our good deeds? Are we supposed to let them shine before others so that they may see our good works and give glory to our Father in heaven? Like, do those not directly contradict?
I don't know why the one image that came to mind for me is like making TikToks of handing out Chick-fil-A to homeless people in Charlotte. Like, I feel like that's become a big social media or YouTube trope, is like, I gave this homeless person $100, and then it's got like thousands of clicks, and you're like, faith and humanity restored. And I don't think Jesus is arguing for us to be self-promotional about it, but I think he's also not arguing for us to hide it. I think it really comes down to a check your heart kind of situation. Like, am I doing this in order to be perceived a certain way by others, or am I doing this because like the love of Christ compels me to do it? And I think if we are earnestly responding out of our hearts to the love of Christ that is compelling us, I don't think that doing anything is problematic.
Yeah, I like what you said. I think the answer is probably extremely complicated, but it has to start or entail some level of it's all about the heart. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's kind of where this award falls apart for me a little bit, because Darcy does say, surely you must know it was for you. It was all for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, is his saving of Lydia and Jane self-motivated? Or is it a pure love for Lizzie? Just like when the Beast lets Belle go from the castle, like, I finally understand, you need to see your father, I'm going to let you go, it's what's best for you. Because he's finally learned to love her, right? And so he can let her go. Or is it like he's playing chess, not checkers, this is the move that gets him where he wants in the end? Obviously, it's a both and, or like it can be a both and, so it's hard to know. Only God knows the heart. But all that to say, I would like to be more like Darcy in the way that he is so humble. And I think about the Tim Keller humility quote where he's sort of like, a truly humble person, you know, they don't think lowly of themselves. They just think of themselves less often. And I think that's one of those things that's like impossible for us to white knuckle and like actually try to apply. That's something that the spirit has to do in us over time.
Yeah.
That we just trust that God will make us less and less self-absorbed over time. That's what's so great about Christianity, Graham. Like, we really do just show up at church and take communion and read the Bible and pray. And like, God does everything. Like, all of our change is supernatural. We don't accomplish any of it. We just show up and he works.
Hmm. Jesus Take the Wheel, Carrie Underwood, Lazarus Song of the Decade, perhaps?
I've never been a fan. Sorry. Ah,
dang. Okay. Moving on.
So that's it for the awards. And now onto our special guest.
This month, we have my friend Catherine May with us. Catherine, how's it going?
Going great. Thanks for having me.
What are you up to these days? Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
I live in Charlotte, North Carolina with my husband, Charlie, and our dog, Willow. I am a veterinarian. I pretty much see dogs and cats every day. But when I'm not working, I love to be active with my husband, playing tennis, golf, hanging out with our friends. But when the weather is bad, probably my favorite thing to do is curl up on the couch with some popcorn and watch a good movie.
And what is a way that you've seen the gospel or biblical truth in something you've watched lately?
So I have seen the gospel in the movie She's the Man. It came out in 2006 when I was in high school. It's one of my favorite movies. I've probably seen it 1,000 times. There's this scene where Duke is opening up to Viola, but he thinks that she's a boy.
Why do I get the feeling you don't do this very often?
Man, I'm not really good at talking to girls.
Why? You're hot.
What?
You know, you're an appealing guy, man.
Look, I don't know. I just always say the wrong thing.
Okay. All right, come on. Let's get up. I want to try something where I'm going to act like a girl, and you're going to talk to me, okay?
Ew, do I have to?
Yes. Because I'm Viola. Duke, nice to meet you.
Okay, that was creepy. You really just sounded like a girl just then.
I used to imitate my sister all the time. I got really good at it. Come on. Get up. Come on. Ask me some questions, and if the chemistry's right, things will just start flowing.
Are questions about what?
Anything. Ask me if I like cheese.
Okay. Do you like cheese?
Well, why, yes, I do. My favorite's Gouda.
Oh, I like Gouda, too.
See?
See what?
We're flowing.
We're talking about cheese.
So what? Flow is flow.
John 4:7. Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become a spring of water welling up into eternal life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I may not be thirsty or have to come here to drink water. You know, when you read a little bit further, it comes out that she ends up having a couple different husbands, and she really is kind of an outcasted woman. And if she really knew that she was talking to the God of the universe right in front of her, she probably wouldn't just walk up to him, talk to him about this water, or even request this water from him. But she thinks that he's just this Jewish man sitting there, and she ends up able to, you know, kind of be vulnerable to Jesus and open up to him, and then actually receive this living water from Jesus. And then she can go back and, you know, really have a changed life. And it kind of makes me think about this scene with Duke and Viola, where he, because he doesn't know that she's actually a girl, he thinks that she's a boy. He's able to kind of open up to her and be really, really vulnerable. And they end up having this really sweet moment.
So it's about like Duke's specific inability to talk to girls.
Yeah, I think the tricky part in this scene is that there is no clear, you know, kind of Jesus character. And so obviously in my story that I kind of gave out, you know, the Jesus character would be more Viola. But in one sense, I think you could flip it around and say, hey, Duke, she was so scared to open up to Duke and of who she really was when he was willing to accept her from the beginning. So I think you could kind of flip the scene around and say he was that Jesus character. And lastly, there's this final scene in the movie where Duke finally finds out that Viola is a girl and says, you know, maybe if I'd have known you were a girl, I wouldn't have talked to you like we did and got to know each other the same way. And that would have been a shame.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for sharing. That was awesome, Catherine. And will we see you at the Jimmys in a couple months?
Absolutely. I can't wait.
Sadly, we have to stop the discussion there. But before we close, here's a quick shout out to all of our supporters on Patreon who make this discussion possible. Samantha Armas, Kelly Barkley, Courtney Kristen Craig and Heather Carlock, Tanner Carlson, Gabe Doherty, Jacob DeRizio, Ben Dunbar, Thomas Eldridge, Rebecca Entwistle, William Harwood, Graham Janet and Ken Hooten, Taylor Huffman, Hunter Keys, Maggie King, Daniel Lee, Bess McLawhorn, John Pabone, Scott Pahacek, Logan Russell, Andy Simmons, Will Smith, Kim Streamer, Helen Webster, Clay Young. You can find us on our Instagram at Jesus Movies, but for $1 a month, you can get our weekly update, a vote to movie picks, shout outs on the podcast, features on the Instagram, and a ticket to the Jimmys by becoming a patron at patreon.com/JesusMovies or on the free Patreon app. Please write us at JesusMovies@gmail.com. And lastly, if you're listening on Apple, leave us an honest review. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jesus and Movies podcast, and we hope you found some goodness, truth, and beauty. Know that Jesus might not be a proud, unpleasant sort of fellow, but that you might be wrong, entirely wrong about him. And we'll see you next month.